Muller House Meeting, Friday morning, 23rd September 1977. When I arrived in Elmau on Tuesday, the 6th of September, I was somewhat exhausted by the journey. But it was a sunny day. And after a good rest during the night, I was still somewhat tired. But it was a brilliantly sunny day. And Elmau looked radiant in smiling beauty. Because I was tired, I couldn't contemplate doing anything like a long walk. So I just walked down slowly to where the Kaltenbach leaves the precincts of the guest house and goes under the bridge over the main road. And I stood there, taking in the sunshine and the beauty as restfully as I could. And it was not possible for me to avoid being aware of this weakening old body. And it struck me so strongly that life was now unpicking, pulling apart, so to say, the different constituents that make up this form which you see of the speaker. And I looked at the young, vigorous, rushing waters of the stream, singing with the joy of life. And gradually, I awoke to the fact that there, right in front of me, was life gathering strength. And here was life which was gently declining. And at first I was conscious of the difference between the two. And soon, listening to that stream singing and enjoying the brightness of the sun and the clarity of the mountains, that difference began to fade away. And it disappeared. And there was a state of communion, on a small scale only, but a state of communion in which one became aware of the fullness of life. Here was life in its aspect of decline. And there was life in its aspect of strength. But these were all parts of the one life. And when that realization of the oneness of this life became quite strong. The sense of weakness was the perfect complement to the awareness of the strength of that young life. And as the minutes passed, this slowly encompassed the whole of Elmal around. It's an extraordinary thing that when that heavenly bird with golden wings, the heavenly bird which is the spirit within us, wakes up and rises up on its wings, all the differences, all the states which are not communion disappear. And that is the awakening to the true nature of total reality. And that total reality includes everything, absolutely everything. It is our limited consciousness which makes us too preoccupied with ourself alone, instead of being constantly awake to the total reality, which means to be constantly in the state of communion. And then, what is commonly called the old and the dying is completely at one with the young and strong and living and fresh. And the separation, the lack of communion, is only due to one's own ignorance, to one's own state of preoccupation with self. And when that sense of the living and the dying existing side by side and together intensifies, then one really awakens to the fact that what we call life and death are really one total life, the wholeness and the fullness of life. And in that awakening is the experiencing of immortality. When one awakens fully to that, unity of what appears to be dying and what appears to be living, when one awakens fully to that, then death is no longer disruption. It is the gateway to immortal realization. But do remember that this realization is not mine. It is not yours. Because the words mine and yours imply separation. There is nothing which is mine. There is nothing which is yours. There is only the one immortal, immeasurable, total being, the one total reality, transcendence itself, God itself, Gottheit, as Eckhart said. There is only that. And that in its wholeness, its uttermost holiness, remains the unknown, the unknowable. Sufficient for us to realize that when this separative self-consciousness, this isolative self-consciousness vanishes, then that transcendent reality expresses its whole self and embodies it in the one word I, and that is the only I in the whole universe. The only real I, the immortal I. And death is the other pulse, the other side of the pulse of creation, of life, other life. You see, when one realizes that, one begins to know what communion and living in communion implies. The total freedom from all sense of separate selfness. When there is that freedom, one doesn't try to grasp anything for oneself, but is wholly grateful, with reverence, with calm joy, for everything that is given unto us by transcendence. Remember yesterday evening, I said, we as persons exist by virtue of the total non-self, as we call it. If not for that, we wouldn't be just ourselves as we are. Now perhaps it is one of the purposes of our existence so to live and so to become true humans that this vast universe, this cosmos, this transcendence comes to complete flowering as man through each and every one of us. Then the sort of vision which the poets have talked of, that gods shall walk the earth again, will come true, won't it? Perhaps that is one of the ways of understanding our human destiny and of understanding something of the extraordinary depth and power of that word human. We don't know it. We haven't begun to know it yet as a whole race, mankind. Now, when that sense of I has ceased to obstruct the communion, that sense of separate I has ceased to obstruct communion, then you are fully awake to the fact that it is not I or you who is seeing beauty, who is hearing the music of the process of life. We become aware that it is transcendence seeing through your eyes and my eyes. the physical eyes will see in the usual way. The brain by itself will interpret that in the usual way. This thing or that thing. This person or that person. But if this sense of separation is quiet and all the senses work rightly and peacefully, then in addition to what you as a person see, something else happens. There is an extraordinary total seeing, because now not the brain dominates, but mind. And you remember yesterday I tried to suggest the difference between mind and psyche. Psyche and brain on the one hand and mind on the other. When mind takes over like that and is in charge, as Browning wrote in his poem, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. You remember how in Genesis God made this, that and the other and saw that it was good. And what is good? What are the words of Jesus when somebody said to him, "Good master," and he answered, "Why callest thou me good? There is only one good, and that is God." So you see, when the sense of I disappears, when you put it in its proper place, as I said yesterday, put Mephistopheles in his proper place, then the eyes of transcendence also look through your eyes. Your eyes and my eyes get tired. They go to sleep. But the eyes of transcendence, of pure mind in total seeing, are the sleepless, immortal eyes, ever bright, which never dim at all, under any circumstance, and see totality. When you experience something like that, you realize what it means to live in love, to live wisely, what it means to be good, which is not just the opposite of bad, but to be God, in which all what we see and call good and bad, and we are the makers of the separation, that separation disappears, and you transcend this duality of good and bad, good and evil, and its conflict, its terrible conflict. The two become integrated into one whole total life. And you see that it is good. It is God. Now you see what meditative walking can do. And it is the same with everything else. Meditative sleeping, meditative eating, meditative working, meditative social activity. Because we know from our own experience with our friends too, don't we? That when we meet somebody we dearly love and who loves us, there is no separation. There is the meeting, which is the meeting of the one life in two unique forms. And how beautiful that is. Right in accord with the order and beauty of the whole universe, of the whole cosmos. And all that can come to life in us as human beings. You see our potentiality, divine. Who made the word God? Who made the word Brahman or Atma, the infinite or totality? Man made the word. And how and why did man make the word? Because he became one with that which that word stands for. In Brahmanical teaching you have Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. Jesus used the phrase, the Father and I are one. Something of the reality, the absolute reality of such statements comes to life in us. Now in these states, the brain and the sense functions are quiet. If you are confined to the brain and sense functions, we are like the disturbance on the surface of the ocean when there are strong winds blowing or currents flowing. But we ourselves in totality are the ocean itself. The depths of the ocean are silent. They are still. They are everlastingly peaceful. A peace which is not static, but vibrant with life. And in that sense, that peace is dynamic and active all the time. And in that dynamism and activity all the time is the experiencing of timeless reality, of the meaning of eternity, which the brain cannot and should not try to formulate, but which the mind in its totality, which embraces you, includes you, touches you, knows and impresses the living psychophysical organism with that divine knowledge. That is why you naturally and spontaneously live the life of what the world calls a saint. In that state of peace, love in its transcendent reality, not an emotion, not a feeling of possessiveness, not a feeling of special relationship towards anybody, but this universal transcendent reality fills your whole heart. And let us for a moment understand the meaning of the word heart. Heart here does not just mean the physical heart inside the body. The heart of the matter is a phrase we use. That means the essence, the innermost core, the ultimate reality of anything, everything. That's the meaning of the word heart. And heart, with that meaning, is the universal reality, not the special concrete reality of the physical heart inside the body. And then, when that sort of love permeates the whole heart, permeates your entire essence, essential being, then the psychophysical organism this thing which moves about and talks and which goes by your own name in the world, is the meek, the obedient vehicle, the instrument of transcendence. Just a word about the word, just a few words about the word meek. We have the ordinary dictionary meaning, somebody very gentle and will bear pain and difficulty which is inflicted upon him by those who have greater strength, or those who take advantage of his goodness and try to exploit him or move him about as they wish and so forth. It doesn't mean that kind of meekness. This word meek, particularly as used in the New Testament, has a profound meaning. I believe the Greek word is praos. And praos was a word which was used in connection with a young colt, a wild young colt, who was tamed first and then trained and became the obedient cooperator with his master. Then there was a relationship of perfect love and understanding between the colt and his rider. You see? Now, that colt was made meek. And there the meaning of meek coincides, fits in perfectly with the word obedient. To be obedient does not mean to conform because you are forced to conform to authority or power. The word obedient is the Latin ob and the verb audire, meaning to listen, to hear, to listen. When one lives the religious life, when especially through the attempt to live the religious life, one can enter into some sort of state of communion, haven't you noticed that you cease to search for God or perfection or any ideal? You don't search, because if you search or I search, I want something for myself. But if you are in the state of alertness, which is the state of search, then you hear the unspoken. You hear the toneless sound. What people have called the voice of God. But be very careful, don't jump to conclusions, because you are in a sublime, exalted mood and an idea, a nice idea, a pleasant idea has seized your mind that, God spoke to me. When that speaking takes place, when you are in the state of listening and you hear, the brain does not interpret it. It is quiet. Which means that down here in the body, I don't know it. But it leaves an impress upon the whole organism. You have really grown in spirit. That is obedience. So you obey the commandments, as we say. And this is how the deep moralities talked of in all the religious teachings in the same way have come into being. When that happens, I cease to resist transcendence. I don't say, oh, this is painful, I don't like it, oh God, please take it away. If I refuse the God-given in any shape or form, God weeps constantly till I have learned to take it in willingly, joyfully. So I become this thing. This thing, this perishable mortal thing, becomes the unresisting vehicle of transcendence itself. It becomes the Holy Grail. This is the Holy Grail. Your own psychophysical organism. To contain, when I am empty of self, to contain the wine of eternal life. And then I'm no longer a scandal. I'm using the word scandal not in its ordinary English dictionary meaning, but in the old meaning. A scandal is an offense. I think the French scandale has that feel about it. Anyone know about that? Please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not certain, but I think something like that is there. It's used in the New Testament, scandal, in that sense, an offense. I cease to be an offense to reality. Consider now this young stream, the Kaltenbach, full of life and energy. How is it that it is a particular stream? Well, that is geography, isn't it? It's a limited particular stream. It's the water which comes rushing down a mountain between two banks. The right-hand side bank, the left-hand side bank. And those two banks confine this water to a particular course and give it a particular identity. And then, as it flows and meets the Iser, it broadens and widens, and in the course of its flowing it dissolves various chemical substances out of the earth and the rock over which and through which it flows, and these dissolved salts, chemical substances, all go with that stream. And it moves on more and more slowly and majestically till it joins the Danube ultimately and ends up in the great ocean. It ends up in the great ocean, the finite, the limited, the particular. And what happens when the rivers of the stream, the particular stream, meet the ocean? The Kaltenbach has ceased to be the separate Kaltenbach. The Iser has ceased to be the separate Iser. The Danube, the great mighty Danube, has ceased to be the separate Danube. And the ocean, like everlasting Mother Nature, who receives these waters, and the two waters become one. They become blended. They are no longer separate. No longer is there a Kaltenbach or an Iser or a Danube. It is completely united with that ocean. And this is one of the ways of understanding the meaning of the phrase I use, death, the other life. this life is completely gone. The whole of this entity is completely gone. And it is that immortal, transcendent other life. And how does the river meet the ocean? It delivers all that it has gathered in its individual separate journey and delivers all those salts, the chemical salts and so forth, to the ocean. Gives them up as a gift, as a love gift. Sacrifices the whole of itself in order to make that gift. And the ocean receives these waters and receives them with that grace which sanctifies, makes sacred. And that is the meaning of the word sacrifice. Both the individual stream that has performed that act of the complete abandonment of separate self, and it itself, the ocean itself, although it is already infinite, grows in sanctity, in sacredness. Some of the old people of the old civilizations knew this when they praised the waters, when they bowed in reverence to the spirit involved in the waters. And the same with the mountains or the trees or the plants, and the same with us. But the mountains and the trees and the plants and the waters do all this naturally, spontaneously, unconsciously. How do we meet our end? This is a question, an important question. Here am I start as a conditioned being, conditioned and separated by my isolative self-consciousness and my preoccupation with myself all the time. I, a conditioned being, am like, my life stream is like a river flowing between two banks. What are my two banks? That which I call the self, which bears my name, and that which I call the not self, the total universe, the rest of the universe. These are the two banks through which I, as a conditioned self, flow along. My life stream goes through this. And I come to my end through the gateway of death, as we ordinarily know it. The organism dies. And this death is inevitable. This flowing of my life stream towards the gateway of death is ineluctable. Ineluctable, which means it cannot be stopped. From the moment I am born, every breath, every heartbeat takes me nearer to that gateway. See? Now, as I, the particular stream, flow through life, have I collected out of my earth this organism itself? Have I collected out of my earth the life-giving substances, the chemical salts corresponding to the chemical salts of the river? Have I collected my sacrifice, my gift to the ocean of life when I pass through the portals of death? And what are my chemical substances as a human being? are they not love and truth, wisdom and beauty, all the salts, the chemical substances which the river collects? It hasn't got them from the start, it collects them from the world in which it lives and moves. Have I gathered love and wisdom and truth and beauty and goodness as my life stream flows? And when I meet my end, when I come to my end, when I stand in the presence of the Lord of Death, in that glorious moment of truth, of eternal light, do I offer my oblation, my sacrifice, my gift, wholly and totally, withholding nothing for myself, demanding nothing for myself, free of all separation within this cosmos, and therefore in the state of divine communion? Do I end that way? If I do, then the Lord of Death, shining in celestial splendor, fuses pure life, utterly pure life, perfected, made holy, made divine, with eternal life, fuses it together. And it sounds curious to say that, but then that's the difficulty with words, because eternal life includes this life, and yet this mystery takes place. And the divine light thrills with bliss, ananda. That bliss is called in Sanskrit. It is not excitement, it is not pleasure, it is not happiness, it is not an emotion, it is not a thought, it is not a thing of time and space, but of eternity. It thrills and it accepts the sacrifice. And the sacrifice takes place by me in the same willing way, the unresisting way, never resisting death, trying to postpone it or push it aside. Just as the brown leaf of a tree in autumn, when the forces of nature are in right play and the time is ripe, it falls off the tree, dancing with ecstasy as it falls to the ground. The beauty, the marvel of death. And if I am awake to it, it is other life. It is the communion with transcendence. But if I do not end like that, then the Lord of Death grieves, and his face darkens, and that casts a shadow which dims the light of life just for a moment, but only that. But the sadness of it, I have failed to be the holy grail of transcendence.